I'm not just happy, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome and introduce Professor Salwa Karui Elunelli, who is, of course, a dear friend, but more importantly, a distinguished scholar from the University of Tunis, more precisely from the UNS. Professor Salwa Karui Elunelli is a specialist of American literature, and her main interests include American experimental fiction, metafiction, and concepts and issues in post-classical narratology. But I hardly need to introduce Professor Karui Elunelli, as she is well known of most of you for the dazzling lecture and series of classes which she gave in 2023 here when she came to Caen as a visiting professor. She has recently published a series of books and articles, including a special issue of Studies in the Literary Imagination, published in 2020, entitled The Trope of the Mirror in Experimental Literature. Also an issue of The Comparatist in October 2024, about anger as an effective intensity. And in, July 2024, a book chapter entitled The Trope of the Trace and the Poetics of Parody, in a book whose title is Recycling the Literary Text, published with Lexington. Today, she'll be giving a lecture on, as you can see, the ethics of revoked or evoked authorship in American parodic metafiction. And she will also give a class on Friday morning at the MLE in room LE160. And I hope a lot of you will be able to attend a class which promises to be extremely interesting, as usual. So, Professor Karui Elunelli, dear Salwa, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Professor Poplar. Thank you all for being here, and thank you to Professor Armel and the other colleagues for this wonderful topic, actually, of authorship, which speaks quite significantly to me. Actually, I've been working on a number of publications related to authorship, but that was in the last decade, not this one. And thanks to the challenge, when I accepted to be a part of this program this year, the challenge was to revisit the same theme but differently, right? Not to repeat what I said in 2010 or 11, but to rethink it, in different way through different books, and I hope that I'll be able to communicate some of the insights that I could come up with, actually from my research, but also from my teaching, because I often teach texts that include that take the form of the diary or the epistolary, that are highly metafictional, and with my MA and agreg students, who would often tackle the image and the representation or the fictionalizing of the authorial self in these texts, in which the first-person narrator is also a writer. Okay. I prefer to begin with a question about why authorship. Later on, I will say a few words about my title, why evoked and revoked. So death, dead or not dead, right, this author, which means that the debate has not come to an end with Roland Barthes, the death of the author. Especially, I think, I mean this to be addressed in particular to MA and doctoral students. I try to formulate, let's say, not answers, but the more pertinent or interesting or meaningful questions. So why would one worry about the author? Isn't it obvious that any name appearing on the cover page of a book or a manuscript offers an indication of the text's origin? Why would authorship appear as problematical when theorizing literary experience or when examining the nature and location of literary meaning. Related to this question is the one that has triggered the theories of literature and the operations of literary criticism. And the question is, in what moment of the literary experience, the writing or the reception, is literariness and or meaningfulness enacted? So all the interest is in this, right? It's not to say whether this is the real author or not. All the theorizing, at least from the 60s up to the present, are made legitimate by the fact that they tackle authorship in relation to the location of meaning. Who is likely to be the pertinent or the competent reader of a literary text? Who is likely to possess meaningful center of what we read as literary text? Does the act of interpretation seek to establish a correspondence between the structure of meaning decoded by the reader and an authorial intention or the author's plan or agenda? Is this correspondence feasible or likely? Would it be legitimate to argue that competent readership is a matter of such detection, of some original intention? Even though most theories and critical approaches agree on the irrelevance of the claim of intention to the interpretive process, so they all agree that there is no way to debate this dead end about the authorial intention, because even the text ultimately need not correspond to the initial plan that the author had in his mind. Hence, we talk about how the text betrays its reader, or even when we apply the psychoanalytic paradigm about how there is much of the unconscious that escapes the author's conscious control, and so on and so forth. So from different then theoretical perspectives, the issue of authorial intention as a supposed locus of authority is irrelevant. All the theories agree on this. And yet, much divergence exists with regard to the image, conception, and textual scope of authorship. Now, the starting point of the present work is the question made necessary by the self-reflexive fiction of the postmodern age. That is, what is the point of fictionalizing the literary author, the way all these texts do, in an age of exhausted forms, of uncertain creativity, and of the crisis of originality? Is it to induce a revival of the romantic ideal of expressivity, the romantic celebration of authorial aura? Probably not, as the skeptical, self-questioning tendency of American metafiction seems to tell us. To examine the conception of authorship that is implicit in parodic metafiction, this is my area of interest, not just self-reflexive narratives, but those that are deliberately and highly parodic, one may first consider the implications of the parodic mode with regard to the poetics of literary writing, and in particular the bearing that the prevailing practice of parody has on the conception and theorizing of intertextuality and of the location or origin of literary meaning. So the rethinking of the authorship concept has been made necessary by the rise of post-structuralist examinations of the nature of literary text and the location of meaning, as I said. So it was not just a matter of bringing something new to the theoretical scene, but Roland Barthes or Derrida, or as we'll see, were guided, or they implied, this particular conception, sometimes in provocative terms, of authorial death, because the main agenda, the main interest is in debating the nature of and the location of literary meaning, and the nature of textuality, of course, part of the same story. The move beyond the romantic ideal of expressivity and beyond the modernist celebration of the uniqueness of style involved first the highlighting by Roland Barthes of the nature of writing as rewriting, and consequently his description of text as a web of allusions, quotations, etc., that is, as an intricate pattern of repetition through which the text emerges as already an intertextual construct. Derrida's approach to writing also problematizes or problematizes even further the significance of authorship. Examining textuality from a perspective that is grounded in a particular conception of writing, Jacques Derrida undermines the communicative model altogether. Now, even those who, go much into his direction, they are irritated, especially in the Anglo-American criticism, by the fact that his, approach deeply rooted in the philosophy of language does not offer really practical, tools for us when we analyze literary texts, right? And especially the fact that he seems to erase the communicative model, so quite radical in the way he denies not only, the meaningfulness of authorship, but also of readership. In Limited Ink, for especially, Derrida insists that writing, quote, must be capable of functioning... I'm not quite used to the... I apologize when I miss. The rhythm is not really. Voilà. Je peux compter sur toi pour me rappeler, s'il te plaît, que je dois de temps en temps. Okay, so this is the outline. Sorry. Yes. Voilà. Writing, he says, must be capable of functioning in a radical absence of receiver and sender. Of receiver, this is the quote, the sender he mentioned earlier, so I had to modify the quotation. Challenging thus the communicative value of writing. Absence in Derrida's writing, as the, in Derrida's view, sorry, as the condition of writing is not understood as a continuous modification of presence, but rather he calls it a rupture in presence. Earlier on, Maurice Blanchot, in L'Espace Littéraire, describe the emergence of literary space as a process that at once depends on and induces the banishment of the writing self. Dans l'effacement auquel il est invité, le grand écrivain se retient encore. Du jeu effacé, il garde l'affirmation autoritaire, quoique silencieuse. L'Espace Littéraire, page 22. Umberto Eco, in his description of l'œuvre ouverte, in his book L'œuvre ouverte, and his description of openness, the sense of openness, develops also a comment on what he presents as the designed ambiguity in text being a value on which an aesthetics of openness rests in contemporary works of art in particular, and he develops this in, I relied on the French translation, L'œuvre ouverte, pages 10, 17, for example. He says, I quote, l'ambiguïté devient une fin explicite de l'œuvre, une valeur à réaliser. And this joins Genette's own description of hypertextuality in figure 4 as encompassing the ways a text, I'm paraphrasing him, a text transcends its closure and its immanence. So this highlighting, the meeting point is this highlighting of a radical form of openness. Now, what's the value of openness? Of course, it means plurality of meaning, ambiguity as a value, not a handicap, etc. But it means also that the author has no control over his text. Right, he doesn't have the final word when it comes to establishing the meaningfulness of his text. Intertextuality, as it induces a radical form of openness in the literary text, allows it to resist closure and to mandate the value of ambiguity, as Umberto Eco mentioned it, and so to rethink the authority of authorship in new terms, rather than generating a total dissolution of the authorial concept. Indeed, the critical debate about the concept of genre, whether genre is still valid or useful as a guide or as a road sign in our experience of literature as readers, has impacted the hypotheses formulated by theorists in relation to the authorship, concept. So, from intertextuality, I'm moving to genre in order to argue that, I mean, with the assertion of the embedded and substantial intertextuality of writing, we did not solve the issue of authorship. We cannot simply say, yes, the author is dead. And I made this actually connection between intertextuality and the theories of genre, also just to give some maybe and hopefully, interesting insights for your future maybe projects or whatever projects you are working on, because we see the traces of the debate around authorship in all these, in the theorizing of all these concepts. For example, the critical debate about the concept of genre, as I said, so has impacted the hypotheses formulated by theorists in relation to the authorship concept. For instance, the argument put forward by some critics when they posit that intertextuality has become more pertinent a concept than that of genre, that now we don't need even to rely on the concept of genre anymore because intertextuality is more efficient as a tool of analysis and of, rethinking of the way literature operates. And this, in my view, contributes to problematizing again, right, the question of authorial authority. In other words, it made more challenging actually, the task of delimiting the scope of authorial innovative contribution to the edifice of literature. I leave Foucault to the end, to a different part. I will come back to him in a minute. Now, in the scope of fiction writing specifically, the move of the novel genre beyond the traditions of literary realism allowed it to tread more self-consciously the path of intertextuality and intermediality. My own thinking also took me into this direction. And here that the move away from traditional forms of literary realism contributed as well to highlighting the legitimacy of the issue of authorship, right? But as problematical issue, not as already solved question, and that the author doesn't exist anymore. And I was partly here also inspired by one minor point. At least it has been minor because not much attention was given to it in Roland Barthes' The Death of the Author, when he pointed to the influence of surrealism in painting and how much it contributed to this move, beyond the classical paradigms. Such move, then, in the novel, beyond the paradigm of realism, is displayed, for example, in its gradual interaction with painterly paradigms, the modernists and impressionism, its increasing appeal to ekphrasis, even since the short stories of Henry James, for example, its sophisticated experiments with the parodic mode, Ulysses by Joyce. As we reach the post-1945 period, experimentation in fiction writing became mostly assimilated, at least in the American literary scene, to the pursuit of radical forms of anti-realism. A narrative composition that is grounded in a skeptical attitude towards the adequacy of representation and mimesis, hence the prominence of the parodic mode, which sustained the self-reflexive turn which sustained the self-reflexive turn and attests to the move towards a form of fiction that binds its pursuit of inventiveness to the ironic subversion of familiar literary narrative conventions. So in fiction, at least in the story of American fiction, the move or the process has been then moving away from realism to bind experimentation to the search for forms of anti-realism, but not to create something, I mean, innovative in the classical sense, right? So they know they are already entrapped in the déjà vu, as Jean Barthes says. So the anti-realism they pursue is more challenging in the sense that it involves a continuous rethinking of representation with question mark, of the mimetic impulse of fiction with a question mark, etc. Now, and so relying basically on a frequent use of parody. The approaches that expand upon the claim of the authorial death and which were promoted by theorists of parody in experimental metafiction, such as Margaret Rose and Linda Hutcheon. By the way, the reason why I say experimental metafiction, because the metafictional existed even before, right? So we find texts that are self-reflexive. But self-reflexivity does not necessarily imply that the text from within assumes the ambiguity or the paradoxes from within, right? So sometimes, as with the Romantics, for example, it is a way of celebrating art, right? So the reason why I cannot find the term metafiction sufficient, I have to add the qualifier experimental just to point to this particular vein, which is avant-gardist, in the sense that it is sceptical in a radical manner. It doesn't take anything for granted, not even its own constructs. So these approaches, then, I said, tend to suggest that the paradoxes of the parodic mode, so we tend to say that parody is repetition, it is a parasitical, it depends on pre-existing texts. Parody is the literary mode that most confesses the failure of innovation, because the parodist would repeat in different terms another text. And yet, with these theories, in particular, Margaret Rose and Linda Hutcheon, there is a focus on the transformative power of parody. The fact that parody is not only a repetition, it is a repetition with difference. And that the subversive processes of the parodic text are so subversive of form, but also they challenge the content. They challenge the ideas, the ideological content of classical forms. So they need not then abide by the claim of the authorial death, but rather and mainly by highlighting the value of the transformative and even innovative quality of the subversive games of parody. They tend to guide us in a way to rethink in different terms, right? What makes the authority, which is innovation. Except that we have to be disillusioned. Innovation cannot be expected to function in the way it used to. So the assertion of difference, the fact that parody is repetition, but repetition with difference, and how its value is located mainly in its potential to generate a transformation of its archetype through the play of ironic subversion. So all this kind of scrutiny then allow the theorist of parody rather to make, as I said, legitimate probably the claim or the argument that innovation is still possible, except that it it is being approached differently by these writers of metafiction. Now, the scope of parodic subversion of generic conventions, of thematic motifs, which permits postmodern metafictional texts, might suggest that the authority being recast or reinvented in highly parodic, ironic fiction is not exactly silent, as l'autorité silencieuse, as Maurice Blanchot mentioned it. It is rather ambiguous, or maybe silent in the way Ihab Hassan, as I will come to him later on, mentions it. It is ambiguous and paradoxical. So, on the one hand, this authority rests on the oppositional ethos of parody's politics, and its mode is mainly ironic. On the other hand, such authority is challenged by the assumption implicit in postmodern literature that originality is inaccessible and that creativity, so the classical meaning, and that creativity is already confined in the repetitive patterns of exhausted literary forms. Also, the frequency of self-parody in postmodern metafiction dramatizes even more emphatically the functioning of creativity through interpretation. The self-parodic mode, which is quite noticeable in the works of John Hawkes, John Barth, Thomas Pynchon, involves the critical revisiting of key motifs and thematic axes or narrative devices from a previous text by the same author. So the same author who repeats differently and who turns sometimes even into derision a theme or a symbol that he treated more or less seriously in an earlier work. As these elements are repeated in a disruptive version, the author dramatizes the gesture of self-critique as the scope of innovative fiction. So he offers us a real performance of self-critique and seems to point to the fact that this is now the area or the scope of innovation. And more importantly, what the self-parodist do is that he usurps the reader's task and sustains the paradoxical terms of authorial control. So another paradox. So on the one hand, the self-parodic instance is a staging of an authorial attempt at orchestrating the liminality of the textual boundaries. On the other hand, such authorial performance or that such authorial performative orchestration cannot induce any sense of closure. It only gestures towards the rootedness of creative literature in reading, pointing thus to an ethics of recognition, recognizing not only the author's indebtedness to his predecessors, but also to the tension that binds the authorial self to his or her past works in the renewed creative moment. In the American literary scene now, the American literary scene of the postmodern age, I'm going to refer very quickly to two figures. Yes. Voilà. John Barth, who is a fiction writer but the most theory-oriented in his generation of experimental post-war writers. And the second is Ihab Hassan. Is the name? Yes, he's was one of the early critics of American fiction and in particular of the postmodern fiction. Yes, we go back to John Barth. In two seminal essays, The Literature of Exhaustion, published in 67, which counts as a manifesto of what the avant-gardists of the 60s or from the 60s to the early 80s were doing. And the second one, The Literature of Replenishment, that he published more than one decade after in 1984. John Barth argues that his contemporaries can turn the saturated literary forms and the crisis of originality into a subject matter. You think that the novel has nothing to offer anymore? Write a novel about it, he said. write a novel about the impossibility of writing a novel. But this is also very risky because this cannot allow the novel to survive for long, right? Hence, Barthes himself, you know, could not, after some time, you know, remain quite interesting to many of his devoted readers, unfortunately. So they are urged to recast then their conception of authorship, their even practice of authorship, by thematizing the crisis of originality that they are already conscious of. In his fiction, Barthes himself often appeals to and re-fictionalizes the figure of Shahrazad from The Thousand and One Nights. You know, it's not only his muse, but he often turns her into a main character. And, I mean, his point, especially in some of his essays, is that Shahrazad encompasses all the dilemma of the postmodern author, who is compelled to carry out the process of storytelling in order to survive. As with Shahrazad, the moment, you know, she cannot invent stories, of course, she would be condemned to die. So for him, this is, you know, the allegorical figure that stands for the postmodern author, compelled to carry out storytelling or fiction writing while knowing that this is a matter of survival, but also by being quite disillusioned about innovation and aura, authorial aura, in the classical sense. The second figure now. By the way, he makes a very interesting statement about Don Quixote. He said, if you think, you say the novel now is dead, then it must be dead with Cervantes, because Don Quixote was also initially a parody of the chivalric romances, that the novel from the start was imitative of already pre-existing narrative forms. So for him, there is no need to be alarmed or to be desperate. Of course, this is quite debatable. The second is the critic of American fiction who remained quite, you know, let's say, authoritative for a long time, Ihab Hassan, who assimilates the condition of the postmodern author to the Orphic myth. I'm referring to him because he wrote a lot, but his book entitled The Dismemberment of Orpheus, it's an old book, but it's written in a very lyrical, poetic style. And he makes, I think, a very pleasant point, not in the dull language of theory, but in the lyrical language of poetry, about how we can assimilate the author now to the myth of Orpheus, right? Who, after being beheaded and dismembered, and he was, you know, the talented or superhuman musician or artist. So even after being killed and dismembered, his head goes on singing, but the singing leads to a silence, and at least in Hassan's metaphoric language, metaphoric jargon. So Orpheus, the talented musician whose head goes on singing after his death, becomes, in Ihab Hassan's description, the metaphoric double of the postmodern author, whose possibilities of writing correspond to an inevitable move towards silence. Silence, which is, quote, more metaphor than concept, quote, turns consciousness upon itself, alternating the modes of its awareness, or else condenses the mind to repetitions of the same solipsist drama of self and anti-self. What I personally find pertinent in Hassan's approach is that he's neither optimistic nor pessimistic, but he's capable of seeing that there is a lot of risk in what these authors are doing, and also that self-awareness, the fact that there is no way to escape from the déjà vu, right? Donc he sees also the fact that, you know, this is the kind of literature which leads to silence. By the way, silence is not death. In his other book, The Postmodern Turn, he assimilates silence to all the forms of discontinuity in narrative, disruption, fragmentation, right, incompleteness, ambiguity, etc. But when these features and qualities are quite substantial to the poetics of the text. So this is what he qualifies as the literature of silence. And for him, this is inevitable with this situation or with this Orphic condition of the postmodern author. The trope of silence, as developed by Hassan, then gives a clearer content to the authorial paradoxical situation already pointed to by Blanchot when he refers to l'affirmation autoritaire, quoique silencieuse. Now I come to the Foucauldian. I think I have to go back. Yes. Yes, to the Foucauldian author function. Now, in what an author is. Of course, you'll find a lot of actually very interesting articles published in 2002, 2008, and 2007, something, you know, in these years, in which scholars come up with a condensed and synthetic comparison of the Foucauldian the Foucauldian and Derridian and Le Trio and Barthes, you know, conception of absence, of death, and so on and so forth. But the Foucauldian concept of or notion, in fact, I think, of the author function, which is enacted, it's a mechanism enacted in interpretation. So the author function, he says, is the principle of thrift in the proliferation of meaning. It is a certain functional principle by which one limits, excludes, and chooses. So the moment of interpretation, right, in which we delimit and we assert one range of meaning at the expense of others, this is the moment in which we appeal to the authorial. So it is an interpretive function, an interpretive, sorry, construct. Right, it's not something given in. So it's not the historical author. He's more interested in the author function because, as I said at the beginning, he tried to bring a more maybe pertinent or even realistic description of how the authorial issue matters. Right, in the interpretive process, in the moment of reading, the moment we make sense of literature. So the Foucauldian notion of the author function as an effect of interpretation, the act that delimits the text scope of meaning and of meaningfulness, takes on a particular implication that relates to the practice of interpretation in metafiction. Now I'm going to give you examples of texts that already practice this kind of interpretation from within the storytelling process. Metafictional narratives that develop a form of self-critique through the prominence of the parodic mode project a particular interpretation of their archetypal imitated text, but also of themselves. The interpretation integrated to the process of storytelling and suggested by the play of irony and comedy mandates the author function, even though in highly provocative terms that seem to usurp the reader's own space. Now, we are going to see an instance of this. So the two texts I'm going to deal with in relation to this theoretical scene are representative of two let's say, frequent tendencies or trends in the scene of American metafiction. The Book of Daniel by E.L. Edgar Lawrence Doctoroy is an example of what we call historiographic metafiction. The second book by Vonnegut is a revisiting of the Künstler Roman, the coming-of-age novel, if you wish. So, historiographic metafiction, right. Of course, the whole phrase, by the way, was coined by Linda Hatcham in a chapter in her book on the poetics of postmodernism. And her argument is that this is a move away or a movement away from the traditional historical novel, but it's not purely solipsistic fiction. It's not fiction that only thematizes itself, but that also projects a particular relationship, a new relationship with history. History not as a background, history as an intertext. An intertext that that is scrutinized by the novel, by the piece of fiction, and that is put into question. What I personally take from the Linda Hatcham's theorizing, at least through my own reading of the book of Daniel, for example, is the fact that with these instances of historiographic metafiction, historiography, not only history, but the writing of history, historiography is or becomes a main target of analysis and of questioning. So it is a theme. What does the writing of history offer us? So it's not about what it offers literature. What it offers literature, this is the second degree that we are probably invited to deduce. But the narrative from within, right, would rather highlight the issue of historiography as problematical. It's a difference from the, when it comes to historiographic metafiction, its main difference from the historical novel in that it urges a rethinking of the assumed veracity of historiographic discourse, submitting historiographic writing to a critical scrutiny. What historiographic metafiction offers its readers is not just an interpretation of a historical event or a reinterpretation of an epoch, but rather a questioning of the assumed authority of the historiographic discourse. So the target of criticism, of questioning, right, is not a particular event, it's the writing of history, the documents that we read and through which we relate to the past. The interpretive process in historiographic metafiction, I make generalized statements, but my statements are all related, to my text, and they are deductions from the main text that I used. A plurality of themes, so the discursive narrative nature of the historical truth, one of the themes, how this truth is discursive. In the book of Daniel, as I will mention later on, another thorny issue is raised, which is the gap between information and truth. So Daniel is capable of collecting all kind from the archive, all kind of data, of information, right, being recorded about this and that event and so on and so forth. But all that does not lead him to the ideal of the historical truth that he seeks. So there remains an important gap and a highly ironic gap between the sum total of information, which does not correspond to, the ideal of the historical truth. In novels like the Book of Daniel, the questioning of historiography and, the fiction, actually the authority of the fictional writer seems to be also ironically, or with a degree of irony at least, it seems to be located in the way it destabilizes historiography, in the way it raises questions about the authority of the historical truth, of course, on the assumption that traditionally the novel has often sought to approximate the ideal of the historical truth, to come close to the ideal of the historical truth. So this pattern is repeatedly undermined in Dr. Roy's novel, right? By mainly showing how historiography, it does not become similar or, you know, it does not establish an equation. History or historiography equals fiction, no. It does not reach this simplistic equation, but the whole novel seems to dramatize the fact that the novelist can partly build or regain his authority by scrutinizing historiography and by developing a disillusioned perspective on the discursive apparatus of historiography. So in the book of Daniel, which is actually partly built on a fictionalizing, maybe you know the case from the history classes of the Rosenbergs case. Are you familiar with this? In the McCarthyist period, in post-war America, when you know people were easily condemned and put in jail for being communists, etc., right? So there were many trials, but the case of the Rosenbergs, the husband and his wife, their case, il a marqué les esprits, comme on dit, was also quite traumatic later on because they were executed, the only couple to be not only sentenced, but also executed, of course, on the assumption that they sold or they passed or leaked atomic information or whatever to the Soviet Union. Dr. Roy creates this Daniel, who is supposed to be their son, the son of the executed couple, but he changed the name, so they are not the Rosenbergs, they are the Isaacsons. So he's, from the point of his adulthood, the moment of a certain point of age, Daniel is now a young scholar working on a doctoral dissertation, so he's often in the library, and his dissertation is about, right, reinvestigation, the case of his parents through the existing archival documents to see, hopefully, whether they were actually guilty or not, which is, of course, an abortive process because he could never know, and he realized that all the documents are, you know, made up or created with ideological bias, and so on and so forth. The novel is not, of course, linear at all. It is quite discontinuous, and even the subject of historiography is raised through, without in narratology, we say when the proper frame is lacking and the narrative levels are not clearly structured within embedded and embedding levels. And this is what happens. This is what creates the disruption, and we have really to make an effort to find the link. So in different sections, for example, Daniel would reproduce in a highly documentary style the information existing already in real books of history about, for example, the Moscow trials in the time of Stalin. So he keeps comparing what happens in America and in the Soviet Union. The arrival of the big supermarkets in America, you see subjects that are not often related, the techniques of capital punishment from the Middle Ages to the present times. Donc he makes a kind of patchwork of pieces or sections from actual historiographic sources, right, in which he tackles, of course, all the subjects relate to the traumatic issue of his parents' execution, right? But they relate to that, of course, in allegorical mode, not in a straightforward mode of causality. Now, whenever he deals with any one of these these issues, especially topics like the Moscow trials, and he gives all the details. This happens at the beginning of the narrative. So we are led to see, in fact, that the whole ideology of the two opposed poles, the democratic pole of the West and the communist pole of bloc of you know, part of the that is the Soviet Union, that the opposition is really not quite pertinent. Similar things happen here and there, and he makes often deviations in these historical, if you want, sections or these sections that are, as I said, taken from real documents and from real historiography. So we see him, we see him in practice. We see how Daniel is performing that careful and critical scrutiny of historiography, not so much and not only, at least, for the sake of the subject matter being documented, as for the sake of unveiling, right, the narrative, manipulative processes of historiographic narrative. But this is something no one. Decipher this, because we have no voice that frames Daniel's chaotic process. We have only Daniel's voice and what Daniel does. No one is actually guiding us. But we need to read what he's doing, what he's writing down, because he's performing the storytelling in writing and in a diary form. So we have then to make sense, if you want, of what he's doing with regard to the authority of historiography, right? By interpreting at a second degree what he's actually performing. Alors, Daniel's struggle in the novel is with both processes, that of self-writing, the sections grounded in the reminiscence about their early family life before the tragic turn, there that is himself and his sister, Susan, who is now in the psychiatric asylum, and she tried many times to commit suicide. And by the way, are we allowed to repeat? It comes in the novel, but obscene term. Yes, we can do that. Yes, the starting point of his book. Yes, I had the student. Yes, okay. The starting point of his book project is what his sister told him when he visited her. Yes, I have to ask a question. I'm sorry, in my age, you see. He visits her in the asylum, and she tells him, they are still fucking us. So that was the starting point. She keeps saying only that whenever she talks to him, right? And he himself, it keeps resonating, the sentence, in his mind and in throughout the whole process. Time and again, this seems to be the only conclusion he could reach, right? They are still fucking us. So self-writing, because his writing, his storytelling corresponds to his writing of a diary. So the sections grounded in reminiscence about their early life, before his parents were arrested, etc., their adoption later on by the middle-class white family of lawyers, and then his more recent married life. Now he's 25 and he has a son. Donc the self-narration keeps vacillating between these particular moments from the distant past of his childhood to the more recent past of his married life, and in particular his cruelty towards his young son. And the second process is the one of his endeavor at reconstructing the story of his parents' guilt, how the state or the intelligence machinery established their guilt. He tried to know what exactly was so obvious as evidence of his parents' guilt. And he did this by scrutinizing then the discursive play of the historical truth, or what the state authorities and official historiography offer as such. Daniel's pondering on the implications of discursive representation, which actually turns out to be his genuine concern, largely accounts for the shift or the vacillation of his writing between historiographic form, so sometimes it becomes purely documentary, the Bildungsroman, when he tells about his own growth with his real parents and then the adoptive parents and so on and so forth. The political novel, because Daniel is a leftist. He belongs to the new American left. His father was also a leftist. And one of the quotes, yes, putting together all the historic injustices, the last quotation. This is part of his description of how his father, the one, the Zaxon, who was later on then executed, how he brought him up. So by always telling him about history, right? And of course, he would present his own interpretation as absolutely valid and truthful, the father. He's a Marxist, individual. So always telling him about the injustice, about the cruelty of capitalism, etc., etc. And Daniel now, retrospectively, in rewriting all that, maybe in a first reading, one cannot pay attention to this putting all things together or putting it all together. In a second reading, we realize that in the way he tried to imitate his father's manner of reconstructing history by putting things together, that is, by establishing causality, Daniel actually ended up in the conspiracy theory. He ended up with, which is not quite credible, right? So it wouldn't give much credit or credibility to his endeavor, right? So retrospectively, this is what he's paying attention to. How come that we can write history only by inventing these causal links and connections? As I said, in his own practice, he ended up seeing conspiracy everywhere because he was following his father's own method of reconstructing history. Also, in the first quote, so this is about how when his parents were taken to jail and they were adopted or about to be adopted, and how they, that is Daniel and Susan, his sister, became the focus of mass media. While our life is shrinking, another existence, another dimension expands its image and amplifies its voice. And this is not related to them. In this new dimension of life, you are spread into headlines and news broadcasts. Our troops are being captured and killed. So, of course, his sarcastic way of highlighting how mass media creates also a kind of instant mythology to be consumed by readers about how these are, say, les ennemis de l'État, right? So the parents are not there, but Daniel and Susan are likely to remain, real threat to the country and to the system. And he often points actually to mass media also in order to newspapers, etc., in order also to undermine the credibility of historiography, to show us that much of the historiographic accounts that survived time were initially based or influenced or in relation to instant journalistic coverage, right? And that the instant immediate journalistic coverage was serving, readers who were looking for sensational effect, or we see for these exciting stories of people being executed or whatever. So one of the aspects also that allows him to undermine the authority of historiography. The fragmented, discontinuous narrative construct that Daniel ends up producing allows him to detect what is at issue in the historiography of post-war America, America of the McCarthyist witch hunt policy. His scrutiny of encyclopedic documents, which partly furnish the intertextual configuration of his writing narration, lays bare leads to a debunking of the gap between information readily available through technologically assisted accumulation of archival data and the historical truth, the point I mentioned earlier. The authority of the authorial Daniel is thus established not in the totalizing quality of his ambitious book project, but rather in the incomplete, fragmented glimpses that the critical and skeptical outlook informing his writing allow him to access. Detecting the irrevocable gap between information and truth, the historical truth that cannot be the sum total of the verifiable pieces of information, leads him to a form of temporary authority. So an authority that is paradoxically also dependent totally on this moment of skeptical scrutiny of historiography. Similarly, Daniel's attention to the functioning of the state apparatus allows him to pinpoint the constructedness of the truth. Here I'm referring to the instances in which he refers to the FBI agents when they visited their home, when they arrested his parents, but they also took many of the books that were inside the house, and Daniel enumerates the books that the FBI agents took with them. One of the books is supposed to be a fairy tale from Russian originally, or written in from Russian culture, but translated into English because his father was a Marxist, so he picked up also the fairy tales that would suit the ideology of the family. And he gives us a passage from the fairy tale, which turns out to be, something different. So it is more of a propaganda, in fact. It is presented as a fairy tale. It is more of a propaganda for the communist, let's say, regime, etc., how forests and rivers would be not destroyed, would be transformed into, something very beneficial to humanity, and so on and so forth. So it is the fact of giving us this long quotation allows him also to show us, of course, the not only the absurdity ideological manipulation, but also how one of the perversions of cultural discourses is that so fiction, right, and fabulation is offered as historiography, and historiography is turned into fairy tale. So catastrophic transformations that the Soviet regime created are turned in a fairy tale into an idyllic change in and happy change in people's lives. So it's a way of showing then the perversion in the two dimensions or in the two axes. I'll try to make it short. So just the last point about the book of Daniel, and then I move quickly. How much time is left? 15? Okay, great. Yes, I will be done by then. Towards the end of the novel, Daniel begins with this book project of writing the real historical account about his parents. So what he does is also something like a police investigation, which turns out to be abortive, of course. It doesn't lead him anywhere. At the end, he found himself comfortable by accepting that what he's writing will be no more than a novel, right? So he reaches a form of reconciliation with the impossibility of the historical truth by building also his authorial authority on the function or the status of a writer of fiction. But even this is not really the happy end. He spoils everything by having the last section of the novel focused on Disneyland. He uses a very, very trivial pretext to have a long passage on Disneyland. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to read that, but I can, tell you about the pages if anyone is likely, would like to go to it. So as a world of simulacrum, right, of created parallel world in which everything, of course, is fake. But also he mentions how, or he compares, let's say, the implicit narratives, the visual narratives of Disneyland. He relates them, yes, to the opposite paradigm or the opposite messages created by authors like Mark Twain, you know, the classical American novelist. So he establishes, let's say, a clear juxtaposition and even rupture, right, between these, you know, let's say, values vehiculated and mandated by Disneyland, which made obsolete all the thematic range and the value schemes already promoted, especially by late 19th century and early 20th century American writers. So the comparison itself tells us that Daniel is not quite also comfortable with his status as a literary author, because he knows that what he will be writing will be turned into a cheap, even trash commodity by Disneyland, and that that will speak to people more than what he will be writing. So maybe because Dr. Roy is doesn't want really his readers to hate him, maybe. Don't yes, he masked this. So the novel seems to end on an optimistic tone. But when you really read carefully the extremely detailed description and comment, sarcastic comment on Disneyland and the evocation of names like Mark Twain, we see that, or we can easily deduce that Daniel is already disillusioned about his authority at the very moment that he reaches it, because of the existence of these cultural artifacts of, you know, of simulation. Right. I move on to the next example, which is the novel is maybe more pleasant to read because it's full of comedy. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. and Bluebeard, published in 1987. Bluebeard, which is clearly, you know, an example of the Künstler Roman. Now, again, in the theorizing of postmodern fiction, Linda Hutcheon has suggested that the growth of self-consciousness in the novel is signaled by the shift from the Bildungsroman to the Künstler Roman, with its focus on the development of the artist. This is in her book, Narcissistic Narrative. But actually, what these writers offer, I mean, what makes the theme of authorship interesting to investigate in a novel like Bluebeard is the fact that it's not simply or unproblematically a novel about the coming of age of an artist, right? So it revisits the connection between the authorial self and the world of politics, right, the sense of commitment and even involvement in political issues and debates and so on and so forth. Also the fact that in Bluebeard we have a narrative in which storytelling is double. So the character whose name is Raybo Karabakian, he's a painter. He introduces himself as a one-eyed painter of Armenian origins. He lost an eye during the war, so he was a veteran, and who acts now mostly as a political cartoonist, he says, a paid political cartoonist for some local newspapers. Of course, the fact that the storytelling itself is a double process. So he begins by, you know, writing his autobiography. That's his initial project. But then, you know, in the middle of the experience, or maybe at the early stage of the experience, he begins to simultaneously develop a diary on the advice of his female friend of the moment, right? Diary and autobiography. The problem is that he could not keep the two texts separately. I will come to it, but I need to make just a point about the subversion of the Künstler Roman. Actually started even with the American Romantics. I mean, I'm referring to Herman Melville. Right from Melville's Pierre or the Ambiguities, which is a novel about the rise of an American writer at the time of the American Revolution, etc. But it is highly, it came in the Romantic Age, but it developed a highly anti-romantic image, right, of the American authorial self. So the novel Pierre or the Ambiguities allows us to see that in the American novel, even right from the midst of the romantic sensibility, the tradition of the coming of age of the figure of the artist was the target of much ironic subversion. The optimism of Anglo-American romanticism about authorial creativity is eclipsed in Melville's text by the constant eruption of romantic irony. So the text is self-destructive or self-deconstructive continuously, which lays bare the paradoxes of the writing process and in particular those of a national literary identity. So he links, the abortive process of Pierre in Pierre or the Ambiguities is linked also to a highly skeptical outlook at the national project of an American literary identity, an American identity different from the Anglophone world or the Anglo-Saxon. This is why, you know, the novel received a very, very cruel attack and criticism upon its publication. And, you know, it was ignored for a long time because it tackled a national, you know, myth and a national, you know, ideological component of Americanness. Vonnegut's novel, Bluebeard, is read here as an even more radical deviation from the paradigm of the Künstler Roman. The romantic ideal of self-expression is both saturated in the narrative form of Bluebeard and deflated, dismantled in the tone of self-derision that permeates the whole narrative sequence. Indeed, at the level of form, the storytelling is articulated around a double process of self-narration. Ray Bukharabakian, the one-eyed painter, is at once writing his diary and his autobiography. The boundary between the two texts turns out to be meaningless, and the narrative ultimately stages the ethical bond between critical distance and sheer performance. The nexus of critical distance as performance. So even though he complains about it, but we can see beyond Raybo's point of view. Now, if tomorrow we have this session, I'll go back to this issue through the implied author. In Bluebeard, actually, the implied author leads us to the idea that the value of what Raybo is doing lies in the gesture, in the performance itself. But the parody and the irony is in amplifying, you know, saturating the romantic ideal of expressivity by doubling the self-writing. This is a technique that the postmodernists often do. So in novels that set out to be anti-realistic, they would develop realistic details, but realistic details of trivial things, of trivial details in the fictional world. So this kind of amplifying or overemphasizing what they would like to banish from literary writing is for them one way then of dissolving the tradition they are attacking or they want to deviate from, then dispossessing it from its traditional effect. Bluebeard then raises the issue of authorship. From the perspective of authorial self-writing, the meditation it implies through Raybo's performance as narrator and as authorial double, whose artistic creativity is reconstructed, orchestrated secrecy and revelation, The mediation it implies, as I said, sorry, through Rabo's performance. And his orchestrated game, manipulative game of secrecy and revelation. He tells us that he used to be a painter, right? And he was part of the school of abstract painting. Now, no one knows him in the moment of writing his autobiography. So he manipulated public opinion, as we say, by constructing a myth around a locked room. This is why he called himself Bluebeard, right? C'est comme Barbe Bleue, right? He himself says, I am Bluebeard and I have the locked room. So what he keeps in the locked room is made secret on purpose. And, you know, mass media love this, so they keep writing about him and asking questions about what he might be hiding in his potato barn, in his residence, in his place of residence, etc. And that brought him fame, that made him well known. And at the end, of course, we discover what he hides in that barn, in his locked room, which happens to be a trivial painting or canvas, trivial in the sense that it is a canvas in which he implements the pictorial style of realism, of mimesis, when in fact he claimed to be part of the part of the school or the trend of abstract painting. So through Rabo's then play and manipulation and the game of hide and seek, etc., we see him also performing then this, as I said, this authorial then experience and status as a kind of game. He himself is quite farcical. He's not serious about, you know, it's a way of teasing public opinion and mass media and so on and so forth. The authorial figure, that is Rabo, admits the fact that self-writing does not only involve a struggle with the inadequacy of the verbal medium, but also a struggle with an unintended overlap between different formal or generic frameworks, because he could not control the boundary between the diary sections and the autobiographical section. So his text goes out of control and the two sections end up overlapping with each other. So the narrator's sense of loss between the two representational constructs, diary versus autobiography, is added to that sense of loss, is added the pictorial motif. Painting is not only part of the satiric thematics in Vonnegut's novel. There is a lot of satire about this, the market of art, the commodification of the aesthetic, etc. It is also the trope. Painting is also the trope for the self-defeating gaze, right, that informs or conjures up the narrative's double sequence and double subgeneric frames. Attending to the plurality of irony in Bluebeard will unveil how the narrative gestures towards breaking through the bond between self-representation and the cult of the authorial self. We can come up with this main target of both thematizing and of derision, the cult of the authorial self. Navigating the doubleness of the narrative space, diary and autobiography, Rabo dramatizes his double banishment or defacement from the literary space that his writing produces. Here I'm using also Paul de Man in his article Autobiography as defacement. He develops an interesting point about autobiography as maybe the most respectable form of self-writing, is a mode and a genre that necessarily produces an authorial defacement or banishment from the text. Right. A conclusion. Yes. You are right. Yes, but let's just look at this. I should have shown you this before. This is the opening of his narrative. Having written the end to this story of my life, I find it more prudent to scamper back here to before the beginning. I promised you an autobiography, but something went wrong in the kitchen. It turned out to be a diary. We can always send out for pizzas if necessary. We see he gets lost in his own metaphors too, right? Part of the comedy. Come in, come in. Examples of self-derision also. Okay, conclusion. Yes, the narrative borders. Yes, maybe I can go back to this tomorrow. He's also quite self-conscious, self-critical, disillusioned too. But there is a lot of bitterness in Raibu as well that we shouldn't miss about, right, the fact that he has to be really quite dishonest in order to save his authorial, status or position. Now, the concluding remarks. First of all, bringing back the debate and the tension around authorial aura, even though within the terms of self-irony and self-critique, have mandated a rethinking of authorial authority as a textual component, which can attest or may attest to a performed sincerity. So there is at least a degree of sincerity that we see in performance or performed by having these narratives that bring back the issue of authorship without claiming to reach any final solution or final conclusive statement, right, about the authorial authority. Second, if authorial authority is revoked through the prevailing modes of parody, self-irony, etc., it still remains an authorial gesture that counteracts any totalizing tendency in the interpretive process. As a performed ethical gesture, the parodic mode of literary self-reflexivity brings the unveiling of the radical openness of literary constructs to a problematizing of the Foucauldian author function. Now, Foucault, in the same article, said that the author function may disappear as culture develops, etc. Here we have the evidence, at least, that it does not disappear, but in fact it is being recast. Donc il y a une sorte de refonte, right? From within these texts that are extremely self-aware, but also quite skeptical. Recasting authorial, last point, recasting authorial authority turns out to be grounded in the authoritative reading of the classics that parodic metafiction brings to the foreground. This is the case in particular with narratives that preserve either the affective intensity of literary thematics or they preserve the politics of the literary thematics. And I would like to conclude here with the question, would it be possible, for example, to go on reading or to go back reading Robinson Crusoe in the same innocent way as a universal text about human heroic survival in an uncivilized space after having read Foo by Coetzee? It's impossible to reread Robinson Crusoe in the same naive or simplistic way. For those who read, I think, or would have the experience of reading the Book of Daniel, I'm sure that you won't approach historical fiction in the same way anymore. And this is authoritative. Thank you very much.